Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
Constantly making trips to Home Depot? Introducing Drop, the app that rewards you for every shopping trip. Earn free gift cards for shopping. Download the Drop app now and use code DROP33 to get $5 in points.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And we're just sitting down to a nice looking little dinner here, aren't we?
Oh, yes. I mean, we got the white tablecloth. We have all the various different dining implements here. Extra little forks and spoons that I'm unfamiliar with.
They're for gouging.
Ah, good, good. Because we have quite a feast prepared for ourselves here today. A dangerous feast.
Yeah, we wanted to think about an interesting aspect of human life, which is how often we put trust at a very level of life and death into people who do a very mundane task for us, which is preparing food.
Yeah. I mean, at a basic level, mundane, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, with the appropriate skill, it becomes an art form. But we tend to think of just like the very basic idea of someone, say, opening a can of noodles or cooking it up for us. It doesn't require any high science.
Yeah. And even if you, even if you're talking about preparing food yourself and it not being something that someone else has cooked for you, a lot of times you're going to be using ingredients that you, just assume, are properly vetted. These are safe to eat, that the nuts I'm getting out of a jar of nuts are not contaminated with E. coli, that the peanut butter I'm using doesn't have salmonella in it. Mm-hmm. But that may not be a safe assumption depending on, I don't know, where you live, what kind of industry regulations are in place and how well they're enforced.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of it comes down to just the human history of cooking and just culinary preparation, right? Because early on, humans learned the value of cooking, a means to basically externalize digestion and aid us in the consumption of things that we would not otherwise be able to eat.
Yeah, that's a thing that's easy to forget about. I mean, if you're sitting down to a piece of chicken or steak, I mean, you probably wouldn't want to eat it just straight up raw, but it could be done if you were in a pinch. You know, you could chew it. There are a lot of foods that you just simply can't eat without some cooking.
Right. Things, yeah, that would just kill us if we ate it without proper preparation.
Or they'd be just inedible, you know, too tough or too, you know what I mean?
Yeah, cooking improves the taste. It can tenderize the food in question. It can kill off pathogens that would otherwise be of dire consequence.
Of course, another interesting thing about cooking is that it, in some cases, I think, denatures our food in a way that allows us to sort of separate ourselves from the means of production of the food when we're eating it. So we, you know, like cooking a steak makes you think about it as a fundamentally different thing from the flesh of a dead animal that had to be murdered in order for you to eat this.
Oh, indeed. Yeah.
I mean, so it kind of allows you to put some distance.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we layer language on top of that. Uh-huh. You don't go to the restaurant and order pig. You don't go to the restaurant and order cow. You order pork and beef.
Pollo and gallina, very different words.
Yeah. And so, and on top of that, you know, the butchering of animals, culinary preparation in general allows us to more precisely choose what parts we're going to eat. Mm-hmm. What parts are delicious? What parts are nutritious? What parts are inedible, and or deadly? So you keep that tasty crab claw meat, but you throw out the dead man's fingers.
You know, I've always wondered this and I've never been able to find a good answer so far. Maybe there is one out there. Supposedly, apple seeds have a little tiny bit of cyanide in them. Hmm. And I wondered has anybody ever eaten so many apples, seeds and all, that they've gotten cyanide poisoning?
Hmm. There have been days where I feel like I've eaten that many apples, but I'll have to start counting the
Robert,
seeds.
Are you a secret competitive apple eater?
Someday, because that's like I find myself eating more and more apples. I think maybe it was Michael Pollan who pointed out that if you're not hungry enough to eat an apple, then you're not really hungry. And you shouldn't snack. Huh. And if you are going to snack, hey, an apple's great. So I just tend to go to the apple for my snack needs if I'm, you know, in any level of self-conscious about my my diet.
But, you know, sometimes you're just hungry enough to eat poutine and not anything else.
It's true. Sometimes the apple is not going to scratch that itch.
Well, speaking of fruits, it looks like our first course is arriving. What is this here?
Ah, we have some ackee fruit to enjoy here.
Now, I've never had ackee fruit before. What's the deal with ackee fruit?
Ackee fruit is really interesting, and I had not actually experienced ackee fruit until just a couple of weeks ago when I went on a family vacation to Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
Ackee is like the national dish, the national fruit of Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fruit, but it's not your typical like Western idea of a fruit. For example, you have this yellowish or orangish fruit on a tree, and then when it ripens, it pops open, and it looks like a three-eyed creature of some kind with the big black glassy eyes inside of it.
Wow.
The glassy eyes are seeds.
So it's kind of a Jim Henson Dark Crystal kind of creature.
Yeah, it really looks kind of alien and weird. But then, when properly prepared, what they do is they take the seeds out. They cut out some of the membrane, and you're left with these little yellowish looking lumps.
Mm-hmm.
And the main dish that is prepared there is that they take it and they fry it in a skillet with some bits of codfish. So ackee and saltfish is the dish. Some onions in there as well. And it ends up tasting about like scrambled eggs. It has that kind of consistency. It's not a sweet fruit at all, but it's very good.
That's nice. So it's not sweet. What does it taste like? Is it kind of spicy or is it kind of,
I never had a real sense that it had much of a taste. But it's in there with a little bit of fish, some onions. It's fried up.
It's more of a texture kind of
thing.
Yeah,
more of a texture. And the texture is, I think, closest to scrambled eggs. That would be my main comparison there.
Well, that sounds like something worth trying.
Yeah, I highly recommend it for anybody who goes to Jamaica for no other reason because it's the national dish there.
Now you said they toss the seeds out, right?
Yes, because as I'll lay out here, the seeds are poisonous. this plant was originally native to West Africa, migrated to Jamaica in 1778, apparently due to Jamaica's first botanist, Thomas Clark, who introduced it there. The ackee tree is actually known as Bligha sapida, and it's named after Captain William Bligh, the notorious pirate. So, interesting history there. But where the poison comes in is that unripe ackee fruit contains a poison called hypoglycin. And actually, there are two different varieties here in the fruit. There's hypoglycin A and hypoglycin B.
Which one is worse?
Well, A is the main problem here. So you have extremely high levels of hypoglycin B in the unripe fruit.
Mm-hmm.
But then the fruit ripens, it pops open like some sort of alien creature and stares at you with its three black eyes. And at that point, you open it up, you remove the seeds. So the only edible portion is the yellow areole, which is surrounded by, again, the toxic seeds And there's a membrane at the base of the seed mantle that's also poisonous. You have to take that out too.
Okay. So it sounds like if you don't know what you're doing, you shouldn't try to eat an Aki fruit.
Right.
Talk to somebody who's familiar with this fruit and knows how to carve it up right.
Yeah. But luckily, if it's on the menu at a place in Jamaica, like they know how to cook it. Like everyone has familiarity with this particular dish there.
But you are saying in a survival situation, stick to the scrambled eggs. Black hole eggs.
Yeah. Yeah, because someone who knows how to deal with this, they're going to clean it, they're going to wash the fruit afterwards, it's going to be boiled in water, then they're going to throw out that water because that could contain a trace of the poison. And it's going to be perfectly good to eat. It's going to be rich in fatty acids, vitamin A, zinc, and protein. But if you were to eat it, the unripened version, you could get what's called Jamaican vomiting sickness.
That sounds like a not very fun sickness.
Yeah, it causes a lot of vomiting and can lead to coma and death. And the biochemistry of it is pretty interesting. It kills you via a form of hypoglycemia or low blood sugar.
Oh.
So normally, as the body uses up the glucose in the blood, your liver releases glucose that it stores in the form of glycogen. The toxin, however, halts the process. Mm. So a few hours after ingesting all of this, your body glucose crashes and just leaves you hypoglycemic.
Oh, this sounds similar to some, not poisons, but venoms I've heard of before that attack by causing an insulin spike in the body and dropping the victim's blood sugar to dangerously low levels.
Huh. Yeah. It sounds like those are probably similar.
I think there's a snail in the ocean that does that or something.
Hmm. All right. Well, what do we have next on the menu here?
Ah, well, it looks like the next thing arriving is something I'm a little bit familiar with, but haven't had the courage to eat myself. It's something that's straight out of Iceland. And from what I've heard, it's bad news if you're not game. But if you are game, I guess some people really like it. So what do we have sitting here before us? It looks like some little cubes of cheese, like the kind that the tasters hand out at the grocery store and the deli. So it's a little white cube with a toothpick stuck in it. And I guess there's nothing else on the plate, so it looks like you just eat it by itself. Oh, except there's a shot of clear liquor sitting next to it, so I guess maybe you're supposed to take that with it.
Now, what's this smell I'm getting from the dish here, Joe?
You know, as one person, I watched a video online of somebody eating this stuff, and the first comment was, smells like Windex. That is a common description of what this is, which is rotten Greenland shark meat, a national delicacy of Iceland, also known as hakarl. And I apologize if I'm not pronouncing that the right way. I don't know the best way to say hakarl, but there it is. It's compared to industrial cleaning products often in the aroma. It's very high in ammonia. Mm-hmm. So it's going to smell like Windex or like bleach or like urine. Okay. That is the most common point of comparison other than cleaning products. So it's urine, it's bleach, and then also kind of like ambient rotting fishiness of ancient days.
Okay. Now it's of course worth throwing in at this point and reminding everyone that far northern cultures typically have a lot of survival foods.
Yes.
Where, yeah, it may not seem as delightful, but you have to put it in the context of surviving the winter with the foods that can be preserved.
Yeah, this is a common feature of far northern climates where you have dishes that are kind of fermented or preserved in a way that produces chemical combinations that might seem unappealing to people not accustomed to them. So this is Greenland shark meat, and I've never had it before. I've read that the texture is also sort of sometimes compared to cheeses, like it's a little bit chewy at first, but then it kind of descends into a powdery grain kind of texture as it dissolves in the mouth. And they say you are supposed to chase it with a shot of Brinavin, which is an unsweetened caraway schnapps from Iceland that I did taste that when I was in Iceland. And, you know, I love Iceland. It was not a fan of that liquor.
Yeah. Was it potent? Did it like warm you up?
It was very herbal. You know, it was like somebody got some herbal tea and then reduced it down by like, not making it thicker, but just concentrated the flavor by about 10,000 times. And that's what it was. So How do you get some of this, Carl? How do you make it? First, like I say, you start with a nice freshly caught Greenland shark or another shark from the same family, the sleeper sharks, the somniosis sharks. The Greenland shark in particular is the somniosis microcephalus, which sounds like it means a sleepy tiny head.
Yeah.
But the Greenland shark is a really cool animal. It's also known as the Ekalasuak, which is an Inuit term. I've seen a lot of variations on the Inuit spelling and pronunciation, so I think they're just different transliterations of the same term. And it's a huge shark. The Greenland shark gets as big or bigger than great whites. It grows, lives probably for more than 200 years. It grows very slowly, and it can get more than 20 feet long, weighs more than a ton. And they dwell in some of the coldest waters of the earth, between like freezing and about 10 degrees Celsius. And it's funny that it's known for appearing very sluggish. Mm-hmm. They say when you see it in the water, it looks lethargic and impassive. It's just not really impressed by anything. I read one account that said that people just, you can catch them by literally just dragging them out of the water with your bare hands. If they get close enough to the surface. They don't fight much. So it sounds like of all the sharks, it's kind of the most stoic and resigned to the whims of fate. But the question that I had is like, wait a minute, why does it taste like urine? This knowledge about the taste of Greenland shark meat apparently goes back a long way. I found an interesting article by Lindsay O'Reilly in Canadian Geographic magazine about the Greenland shark's significance in Inuit culture. And it's offering another variation on that same name. This time it's Skalugsuak.
Ooh.
And, yeah, I love that. Skalugsuak. And I want to read a little quote from this article. She says, Inuit legend has it that once long ago, an old woman was drying her hair after washing it with urine when the wind suddenly whipped the damp cloth from her hand and carried it out to sea. This cloth, the Inuit say, became Skalugsuak, the Greenland shark.
I love that because it sounds like there's been a recent trend, I think, in a couple of different skits where you have individuals coming up with elaborate descriptions of how bad a beer is.
Uh-huh.
And this seems like a more primal version of that. I can imagine Inuit sitting around eating some of this and saying, you know, this particular meat tastes as if an old woman washed her hair in urine and then threw that hair into the water and it became a shark.
Yeah, it's very flowery. Yeah, it's like somebody is really overriding the Spear Advocate article.
Yeah.
But anyway, getting to the point about the dangers associated with it, if not prepared properly, you don't want to eat Greenland shark meat fresh. You might not want to eat it anyway because it smells like bleach and urine. But let's say you're really, really hungry or you're looking for something to feed your dogs. Don't go with fresh Greenland shark meat because it is poisonous as heck. When it's fresh and raw, the meat of a Greenland shark contains high levels of uric acid or urea and trimethylamine oxide. If it's eaten in high enough doses, it can cause effects that from the outside resemble drunkenness. Sometimes people can say like, oh, this person is drunk on shark, but it can lead to really bad things like nausea and vomiting, oral burning sensations, explosive diarrhea, muscle twitching and convulsions, trouble breathing, and even in some cases, coma and death. And the most toxic ingredient in the Greenland shark meat is the triethylamine oxide. This is a chemical used by the shark as a kind of natural antifreeze for the proteins and enzymes in its body. And it does a good thing for the shark because it allows the shark to survive the freezing temperatures of the water that it lives in without the formation of ice crystals and the destruction of proteins inside the body. So it's a fish that's got antifreeze in it.
Huh.
You know the rule about not eating antifreeze.
Yes. Yeah. That one's drilled in at an early age. You know, I think there was an episode of the documentary series Human Planet in which you see some fishermen actually pull one of these creatures out of the water, and then I believe they feed it to a dog. I can't remember if they cooked it or not.
Yeah, actually, I've read that sometimes the meat is fed to dogs and it makes the dogs drunk, essentially. Oh. But it doesn't sound like something. Don't feed Greenland shark to your pet. If you happen to have some fresh Greenland shark, I don't know why you would, because you typically don't get it fresh unless you catch it yourself because it's so poisonous. And so how do you get the hakarl, the version that's okay to eat, even if some people find it very disgusting? Well, the traditional Icelandic way of preparation is let it rot.
Oh.
And specifically, let it rot under pressure. So you bury it under rocks or gravel for like 3 months, and then you let it rot there. And then you dig it up and you hang it out to dry for another 3 or 4 months. So this has had, you know, many months of rotting, under pressure to press out some of the liquids and then hanging up to dry. And this process supposedly makes the shark safer to eat as the poisons are removed through the pressing and through the chemical action of the fermentation. Another method of preparing Greenland shark would simply be to boil it in several changes of water to leach out the toxins. But the several changes of water is important. You don't want to eat Greenland shark soup made from a broth of the meat. Huh. But anyway, if prepared in the correct way, they say it is very pungent and likely to terrify, tourists. But it's safe to eat. You can eat this rotten shark and not die.
I'm reminded of the episode of The Simpsons in which Homer had an especially long sub sandwich that Marge made him throw out. He ended up hiding behind a radiator, and he would sneak it out from behind the radiator and eat it. It was gray and rotten.
That sounds very familiar.
All right, well, let's clear these dishes away because we have another Arctic dish coming out for us.
Well, it is labeled on the menu as boreal wild game.
Hmm.
It smells very gamey. Oh, I see the description here. This is polar bear meat. We're being offered polar bear.
Oh, okay. Well, doesn't seem like there could be a problem there, right?
No,
people
it seems like
eat bear.
You probably shouldn't eat polar bear, should you?
Well, probably not, but
I imagine
sure
I've
eaten bear before.
Oh, really?
I think when I was a kid in Newfoundland, Canada, for about 3 years, occasionally interesting meats would present themselves, such as moose, or in I think one case there was bear stew. You have to put yourself in a pretty extreme situation, I think, for the question to even come up: should I eat this polar bear?
Yeah, but it turns out that the polar bear, like the ackee fruit and the Greenland shark, is a food that if you are in a position where you find yourself needing to eat it, you better have somebody on hand who knows how to prepare it.
Yes.
And knows which parts to avoid.
That's right. Because the native peoples of the Arctic, they've known for a long time that some days the bear eats you and some days you eat the bear, right?
Mm-hmm.
But on the days...
But some days you eat the bear and then it gets you back.
Yes, because when you do eat the bear, you got to know not to eat the bear's liver.
Yeah.
And as early as 1596, you had European explorers who learned this lesson the hard way, coming down with just horrible illness, like nightmarish illness following the consumption of polar bear liver. Because with many different animals, certainly the kind of animals that a European would consume back home, the liver is totally fair game. The liver is a delicacy. The liver should be eaten.
Right. Yeah. You have a fine French restaurant making a foie gras or liver mousse or something.
Yeah. But then you start dining on polar bear liver and you might feel drowsy, sluggish, irritable. Suddenly you have a severe headache. You get bone pain.
Hold on. Bone pain?
Bone pain.
What does bone pain even feel like?
Well, there's one way to find out. Yeah, blurred vision, and then you're vomiting. And finally, this is where it gets just really crazy, is you start experiencing skin peels.
Peeling skin?
Yeah.
I think you accidentally did your research from the plot synopsis of a Hellraiser movie.
It sounds like a Hellraiser movie, yeah, because in the milder cases, you're talking just flaking skin around the mouth, all right?
Uh-huh.
You know, unpleasant, but hey, not too bad. But some accounts reported cases of full body skin loss. Even the thick skin on the bottoms of a patient's feet could peel away, leaving the underlying flesh bloody and exposed.
Oh.
And then on top of that, liver damage, hemorrhage, coma, and death.
Save your tears. Man, that is messed up. So what's the deal with the polar bear's liver? Why is it so poisonous?
Well, it all comes down to vitamin A, interestingly enough.
Vitamin A?
Yeah.
People take pills of that. It's in carrots. It should be fine.
Yeah. I mean, we've mentioned it being in some of, like, being one of the pros to some of the foods that we're mentioning in this episode. But because vitamin A is important for eyesight, reproduction, fetal development, growth, immune response, and the cellular formation of tissue. That's key.
Can I go on a little side tangent here?
Yeah.
This is a thing I had to research for a brain stuff video once. It's a myth that vitamin A increases your eyesight beyond normal capacity.
Oh, okay. This is the whole, like, if you eat enough carrots, you'll improve your eyesight.
Right. What is true is that vitamin A, and carrots are a good source of vitamin A, though plenty of other vegetables are too. Anything that has beta carotene in it. So like spinach is great too. They will help maintain normal vision, but they're not going to upgrade your vision above the baseline.
Okay. All right. Good to know. Now, if you, like me, take a lot of vitamins, you've probably noticed that on days when you take extra vitamins, you end up with, you know, just splendidly golden urine as extra vitamins leave your body. And that's the case with a number of vitamins. They simply dissolve in water, leave your body in urine. A, however, vitamin A only dissolves in fat. So that means it doesn't exit the body in urine. Instead, it collects in the body's filtration organ, the liver, where it can reach toxic levels. And generally, this occurs over a prolonged period of time. And if it does get out of control, then you end up with chronic hypervitaminosis A. And that, in humans, involves all the various symptoms that we've already mentioned.
That sounds pretty horrible. So wait a minute. How much polar bear liver do you have to eat for it to be dangerous?
All right. Well, to put it in context here, an average healthy human liver contains 575 international units of vitamin A per gram, while a polar bear's liver contains between 24,000 and 35,000 international units per gram. So
wow.
You compare that to the tolerable upper level of vitamin A intake for a healthy adult human, that's 10,000 IUs. Like supercharging your vitamin A consumption to absurd levels.
Why is there this much vitamin A in a polar bear liver?
Well, it all comes down to, I mean, a lot of it comes down to the hostile environment, the necessary biological adaptations. So in the case of the bear, the bear doesn't need that much vitamin A in its diet. You put a bear in a zoo, it can get by with far lower quantities of vitamin A.
Uh-huh.
But in its natural environment, bears are eating a lot of bearded seals, ringed seals, both of which store high levels of vitamin A in their livers and blubber. And a lot of this seems to have to do with the role that vitamin A plays in growth and naval development. So the seals need all that extra vitamin A in order to advance their vulnerable pups into a more survivable stage. So it all comes down to the polar bear needs to eat those seals. It needs to tolerate high levels of vitamin A, so it has evolved to roll with higher levels of vitamin A. It can store those higher levels of vitamin A in its filtration system, in its liver. It's when we eat its filtration system, when we eat its liver, we end up with quantities of vitamin A that we have totally not evolved to deal with.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Tired of wandering the aisles at Walgreens trying to find the best deals? Well, we've got something that'll make your shopping experience a whole lot sweeter. Introducing Drop, the app that rewards you with free gift cards just for doing your everyday shopping. Whether it's groceries, toiletries, or your favorite snacks. With Drop, every purchase earns you points towards fantastic rewards. Download the Drop app now. Use code DROP55 when you sign up to get $5 in points.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing. And of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Father's Day is coming. A day we celebrate the guy who's always there for us. To crack a dad joke. Well, you know what's not a dad joke? Getting $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker with the purchase of his favorite cocktail capsule pack. $50 off. No dad joke. See, this is a dad joke. I lost my glasses today, and guess who I bumped into? Everyone. But the Bartesian Cocktail Maker, it's no joke. Each cocktail capsule contains real fruit juices and all-natural bitters, so dad can make over 60 premium cocktails he loves. Sidecars, old fashions, gimlets, all with the push of a button. So, for the dad who loves a cocktail with friends and a good joke from time to time, get the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. $50 off now until Father's Day. Visit bartesian.com/father to get 50 off the best premium cocktail maker for dad at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
You know, this might be a different kind of category of food than our others, where I would say, you know, if you're having your food prepared by somebody who knows what they're doing, ackee fruit and hackarl, go for it. Mm-hmm. I'd probably say don't eat a polar bear.
Yeah, it's hard for me to get, given the polar bear's recent plight. Yeah, I can't get excited about the idea of eating one of these creatures. I mean, unless it's eat or be eaten. Certainly in a survivalist case, though, I would say eat the polar bear, but know what you're doing.
Not the liver.
And don't feed it to a dog, et cetera. Oh, and it's just a little fun fact. I once wrote a short story in which Captain Sir Richard Francis Burton meets Frankenstein.
Oh,
yeah. Or actually, he ends up meeting Frankenstein's monster, I believe. And the creature in this particular story, I had him consume polar bear liver, and that's how he gets all disfigured and gross.
Wow. Yeah. I'd like to read that, dude.
Yeah, it's out there somewhere. Maybe I'll have to throw up a link somewhere.
Okay. Well, oh, wait, it looks like another course is arriving.
Ooh, what do we have here?
Ah, well, it's a very beautiful plate. It's an ornately decorated plate, and it's covered in very thinly sliced, pale, translucent sashimi, tiny tissue-thin slices of fish.
Mm.
It looks good. So imagine you are in this scenario. You're sitting down to a plate that looks like this, and, you know, it does look good. So it looks so good you eat the whole plate by yourself. But what would you do if you'd just eaten a big plate of sushi and then suddenly you start feeling some strange sensations?
Well, I generally do, but generally that's just the sake.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a different thing entirely. No, this would be more like you're sitting at the table and there's kind of a burning and tingling on the lips.
Oh, that's the wasabi.
And then it kind of turns into some pins and needles pricking at the lips, tongue, mouth, the throat.
Okay, that's a problem.
Yeah, and then suddenly you might start to lose some coordination. That might still be the sake.
Could be. Okay.
But it starts to feel more like there's a nervous system disruption going on throughout your body. You eventually collapse to the floor.
That's bad.
Yeah, and you find your muscles are very weak and sluggish, and eventually you are mostly unable to move your body of your own free will, and then the vomiting begins.
Leaving you barely able to order seconds on that delicious dish.
Now, this is a worst case scenario leading up potentially to death in the event of improperly prepared fugu or puffer fish. Now, I, again, like the other cases, I don't want to badmouth a perfectly good food if it's prepared well. And fugu is a perfectly excellent sushi fish, and it's not inherently dangerous when served the right way, when prepared by a trained chef who knows what they're doing, who has a license to prepare this kind of food. And since the introduction of protective measures like government restrictions on who's allowed to prepare and serve fugu, fugu poisonings and deaths have been rare, but there is a reason that these protective measures have been put in place. I've read that sometimes in Japan, or maybe in certain places, fugu is known by the nickname teppo, meaning gun. And like gun sushi. And that kind of makes sense. So some organs in the pufferfish are naturally equipped with tetrodotoxin, which is an extremely potent neurotoxin. Have y'all talked about tetrodotoxin on the show before?
I feel like it's come up a time or two, but in passing.
It's very, very toxic. By mass ingested, it's reportedly about 100 times as toxic as potassium cyanide.
Deadly stuff.
The scene in the James Bond movie where the bad guy, you know, is committing suicide with the cyanide pill. Mm-hmm. He would need a tetrodotoxin pill, 1/100th the size of the cyanide pill. Very easy to hide in a little compartment. But anyway, tetrodotoxin, what does it do to you? Why does it cause all these problems? Essentially, it works by messing up communication between the body's nerves and muscles by blocking sodium ion channels. And this can lead to paralysis. Especially the really creepy thing I've heard is that it's conscious paralysis. That sounds especially horrifying.
Oh wow. You don't just locked in.
Yeah. Like you're aware of what's going on. It doesn't necessarily knock you unconscious, but you can't move. And you might be having trouble breathing, having a fast beating or irregularly beating heart. It sounds very scary. But like I said, if this is properly prepared, fugu meat, this is not a problem you should have. You'll find this tetrodotoxin in especially high concentrations in the fish's liver and gonads.
Okay.
So the chef who knows what he or she is doing can cut around the right parts of the fish, knows what to do to prepare it right. They're not going to serve you the parts that are going to kill you. But what happens when, I don't know, things go wrong, when somebody doesn't know what they're doing? It's not pretty. I wanted to read from a little case study of fugu poisoning from 1996 that was hosted on a report on the CDC website. So this is a case where there were three guys hanging out and they get some fugu that was, I believe, shipped to them from a friend in Japan.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. And they're like, well, let's try it out. So here's one of the cases. So case one is a 23-year-old man who he ate a piece of fugu, quote, the size of a quarter, approximately 1/4 ounce. So that's not that much.
Uh-huh.
About 10 or 15 minutes later, it says he had onset of tingling in his mouth and lips, followed by dizziness, fatigue, headache, a constricted feeling in his throat, difficulty speaking, tightness in his upper chest, facial flushing, shaking, nausea, and vomiting. His legs weakened and he collapsed. On examination in the ED, his blood pressure was 150/90. Heart rate was 117 beats per minute, respiratory rate 22 per minute, and he had a slightly elevated temperature. And there were a couple other guys who had the same thing. One of them reported that he noticed a tingling in his tongue in the right side of his mouth, followed by, quote, light feeling, anxiety, and thoughts of dying.
Oh.
It induces thoughts of dying. It's kind of interesting. Or maybe he just knew what was up at that point. He's like, oh yeah, just ate some fugu. Time to have thoughts of dying.
Yeah. I wonder if he went into that scenario, you know, knowing because that seems to be one of the attractive things about the fish, about the quote, the gun, right?
Yeah.
Is that it is, there's a sense of danger to it.
Yes. It's in this sense, it's not just a really tasty food, but it's kind of a thrill experience with the knowledge that, you know, oh, if this goes wrong, we could all die. It's, I don't know, maybe kind of like bungee jumping or something. You know that it's inherently safe if your instructor has secured everything properly, but the thrill of knowing that maybe something could go wrong and I could die makes it more exciting.
And in a sense, it's kind of, you know, you go into any kind of restaurant scenario and, you know, you trust that the chef knows what they're doing. And,
yeah.
But in most cases, it's the difference between like, all right, if the food tastes good, then there's a good chance that the chef knows what they're doing. Here's a case where it's live or die.
Uh-huh. but then again, this is something we touched on at the beginning of the episode, but I don't think this is inherently all that different from very mundane, familiar foods, not just interesting delicacies.
It's true. Yeah.
It's like you go to eat a hamburger, and if this is, you know, maybe meat that was ground under unclean facilities and it was served to you undercooked, and you know, the right set of circumstances line up with people failing to do their jobs right and giving you safe food, yes, this could kill you too.
Yeah, indeed. Like most of the items we're discussing here today, they are extreme and exotic examples of a truth that spreads just across the menu for humans.
But I wanted to return to this case. These three guys who got fugu poisoning in 1996. Now, this isn't the only case of fugu poisoning. It happens every now and then, but this was the one case I looked at. All three of these guys survived. So it's not necessarily a death sentence, even if you do get the poisoning. All three were treated with intravenous hydration, gastric lavage, that means like stomach pumping, cleaning the inside of your stomach, and activated charcoal, which I think the idea is that the toxins that were still in the digestive system would bind to the charcoal rather than entering the body's chemistry.
Okay.
So another interesting fact about the tetrodotoxin in fugu, and some, there are other sea creatures that have tetrodotoxin too, like blue-ringed octopus and stuff. Mm-hmm. The pufferfish raised in aquariums with clean water tend to be non-toxic.
Oh, okay. Huh. Well, that would lead one to believe that they're acquiring these toxic properties from something in their diet.
Exactly.
It's
something
you see with a number of different animals, including some poison frogs, for example.
Yeah, and this seems to be the case with the fugu. So what scientists think now is that they get their tetrodotoxin producing capabilities through something in their food, specifically through eating foods containing bacteria. And it now appears to be the case that fugu become toxic by capturing and using tetrodotoxin produced by bacteria that produce the tetrodotoxin. So they don't make the poison. They get it from the bacteria, and they have evolved a resistance to that poison that allows them to store it as a defensive mechanism within their bodies.
Huh. So if you were a spy extracting neurotoxins from a pufferfish in order to assassinate your target, you're using essentially a third party
there's a middleman poison that pufferfish,
yeah. Third generation poison. Okay.
But yeah, I do want to stress one more time, I don't want to be an alarmist about fugu. They say, you know, the chefs who are licensed to serve fugu know what they're doing, and it's supposed to be a very safe experience.
Yeah. Just maybe it's just some guy in your dorm or apartment
right.
building. Says,
what
hey,
I'd
I just
really
got
be
fugu in.
What I'd really be worried about is if you're out, I don't know, snorkeling or something, and one of your buddies catches one.
Yeah.
And says, "Let me prepare some boatside sashimi for us."
Yeah, that would be a good opportunity to turn them down.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Tired of boring lunches? Picture this. You're at Chipotle ordering the same old burrito bowl. But wait, there's more excitement in store than just guac. Introducing Drop, the ultimate rewards app. Just link your card, dine at your favorite restaurants, and you'll earn points to get free gift cards from tons of brands. It's like getting paid to eat. Hungry for savings? Download the Drop app now and use code DROP44 to kickstart your rewards journey with $5 in points.
Dad deserves something really nice for Father's Day, but let's face it, we usually don't do it. Big gifts are for Mother's Day.
Picking something up on the way is for Father's Day. Well, let's make Father's Day something this year with the Bartesian Cocktail Maker. It whips up over 60 premium cocktails on demand, each ready at the push of a button. And right now, you get $50 off the Bartesian Cocktail Maker when you buy one pack of Dad's favorite cocktail capsules. Dad will publicly love that you saved $50 on the countertop machine that crafts premium cocktails on demand. And he'll secretly love that you splurged on him for Father's Day with the gift of a Bartesian. Because the only thing that lets Dad know he's the world's number one dad better than a world's number one dad coffee mug is an artisan cocktail in his hand. Make Dad's Father's Day and Father's Day cocktails with all natural juices and bitters without making any mess at all. Visit bartesian.com/father to get $50 off the best premium cocktail maker for Dad at the best price for you. Bartesian. Premium cocktails on demand.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
All right, well, what do we have next here? Oh, we have a nice cassava root salad and a little tapioca pudding on the side.
Now, here's one I've had before. I've had tapioca pudding.
Oh, yeah. I feel like most of us have probably had tapioca pudding. Perhaps you've had bubble tea with tapioca bubbles in it.
Is that what that is?
I believe in most cases. I always get the kind with the tapioca, but there may be another variety that is available as well.
I've never liked bubble tea. I found it kind of gross. Like, why do you want little lumps in the stuff you're drinking?
I need flavorful lumps in my beverages. I kind of dig it.
Robert Lamb, endorser of lumps.
Yeah. Tapioca itself has its roots, if you will, in the cassava root. So cassava is cultivated throughout the tropical world for its roots, which are just super starchy. Mm-hmm. They contain nearly the maximum theoretical concentration of starch on a dry weight basis among food crops.
So we're exceeding potato territory here.
Yeah. And you can think of them in terms of potato. They're essentially like a tropical potato.
Uh-huh.
Fresh roots contain about 30% starch, very little protein. But yeah, they have a number of different uses. They're used to produce cassava flour. So you get breads, you get tapioca. You can get a laundry starch, derive a laundry starch from it. There are alcoholic beverages that are made from it.
Of course there are.
Yeah. And, there's also a cyanide producing sugar, derivative, that occurs in varying amounts in most varieties of cassava.
Wait. Cyanide?
Yeah. So there's, yeah, essentially, cyanide in the cassava.
Well, good thing there'd have to be as 100 times as much of that as there would be of the tetrodotoxin.
Yeah, it's just to back up a little bit. Cassava probably was first cultivated by the Maya in the Yucatan Peninsula. So quite a while ago, there's been a lot of cultivation of this, a lot of time for humans to work out the kinks, to know what to eat, what not to eat.
Uh-huh.
And even back then, they developed a complex refining system to remove poison from the plant by grating, pressing, and heating the tubers. Okay. And then they also used some of the poison for darts and arrows. So basically, you want to avoid the leaves, which have the highest concentration of these cyanogenic glucosides. And you also want to peel the roots as well, because the peel is also fairly potent.
Oh, but all the nutrition's in the outside.
I know.
Oh, no, wait, that's carrots.
Well, I mean, I always, when I'm eating something, say, like a potato or what is that delicious kind of German cross between an artichoke and a sunchoke.
Oh, sunchoke.
Yeah. I love sunchokes, but I love the texture of the sunchoke. I would never want to eat a peeled sunchoke.
Uh-huh.
But apparently most methods call for peeling the cassava root just to avoid any potential poisoning. On top of this, cooking the cassava tends to remove the toxicity. An adequately processed cassava flour and cassava-based products have a very low cyanide content and are just very safe to eat.
Okay. Yeah. So this is one of these foods, and I believe there are other foods like this that are sort of standard staples that are fine once they've been cooked properly, but you wouldn't want to eat them raw. Are lima beans also in that category?
Lima beans are also on the list of things that, yeah, you definitely want to cook. I want to say red beans as well, red kidney beans, as well, are also on that list. Yeah, just things where, you know, we're fortunate to live in a time where long ago, people went through the, painful and potentially lethal process of figuring out, which part of the plant is good and under what circumstances is it good to eat. So yeah, today we can enjoy tapioca pudding, even though at some point in the past, some Mayans, went to an early grave because they, had to figure out how it works.
That's something I think about often, the debt we owe to our ancestors, the people of many, many years ago who figured out what you couldn't eat and paid for that research with their lives.
Yeah. I mean, without even getting into so many food processing technologies, I mean, just the basic ability to turn grain into bread, et cetera. It's just, you know, anytime I read about all this stuff, I just imagine myself in the wilderness starving.
Right.
Trying to figure out which berries I dare eat and yeah. Which ones will kill me dead.
Can I eat these mushrooms? I don't know.
Oh God. Yeah. Mushrooms is an entirely different, area to consider there because you have so many delicious, food worthy mushrooms, even in our own local environment here. And then so many just deadly ones as well.
Again, the rule with mushrooms is if you really don't know, don't eat it.
Yes, indeed. Yes. And people continue to learn that one the hard way.
Okay. Well, I wanted to find out though, all of these we've talked about are interesting to me in that they become perfectly fine as long as you can trust the person who prepared them. You know,
right.
They're not going to hurt you if you've acquired the food properly, prepared it in the right way, and you check all the boxes and you're going to be fine. But what is the food out there that is not just interestingly dangerous in potentia, you know, in potential, but that actually gets the most people?
Well, you know, prior to this episode, I might have guessed pork.
Yeah.
You know, especially
pork
given
sausage.
That, yeah, or barbecue pork, because there have been some headlines in recent years where there have been barbecue competitions and illness springs up. So that would have been my guess.
Well, there was one report from September of 2009 that the FDA issued, and it was a list of the top 10 most dangerous foods in the United States at the time based on the number and severity of food poisoning outbreaks by food vector.
Okay, so not just like three guys eating fugu and stealing the headlines, but actual
like
numbers.
Thousands of people, yeah. So what was the culprit? You know, was it fugu? Was it ackee? No, it was none of these foods we've talked about even made the list. The real criminal was salad.
Ah.
Specifically leafy greens.
Ah, which would, you know, often feels like the safest thing, right?
I know, yeah. As the Simpsons once observed, you don't make friends with salad, especially if the salad is funneling listeria into your friends' bodies. So I want to read from the report. They say, iceberg lettuce, romaine lettuce, leaf lettuce, butter lettuce, baby leaf lettuce, immature lettuce or leafy greens, escarole, endive, spring mix, spinach, cabbage, kale, arugula, or chard account for 24% of all the outbreaks linked to the FDA top 10. Those outbreaks sickened over 13,568 people who were reported to have become ill, almost 30% of all the reported illnesses caused by the FDA top 10. Don't know if it's still the same today as it was in 2009. I hope this has changed in the past 6 years or so. But as for food that not only sickened people but killed them, I tried to look up food poisoning outbreaks with the most fatalities to see if there was a running thread, but I couldn't find one. It seemed like it was all over the place. It had meats, cheeses, vegetables, packaged food products like peanut butter, bagged spinach. It seems like no matter where you turn, something that you're probably consuming could kill you if something has failed somewhere in the process between the farm and your face.
So what you're saying is that we could have many more six-course dinners like this one if listeners choose to attend it with us.
Right. But I'd say the real takeaway here is that I think the most dangerous foods are not the kinds of foods that make people feel uneasy because they're unfamiliar, you know, delicacies from other countries that many Americans wouldn't be familiar with. They're going to be things that you eat every day.
Yeah, things without that overt danger factor, but still with a very inherent sense of danger if not prepared with a modicum of decency and awareness.
Now let me offer a caveat even to the last thing about salad. I hope you don't take this as a recommendation to stop eating salad. You know, leafy greens are a wonderful thing part of your diet. And here's my recommendation. Don't buy the pre-bagged, pre-washed stuff and just eat it straight up. Buy a head of lettuce, cut it up, and wash it yourself. Get you a salad spinner. It's worth the work. It's very nice.
I don't know. That's a lot of work, Joe. I kind of like just opening the bag, dumping it, and then opening the little packets. And then I have a salad. But,
well,
okay.
No accounting for taste.
If it keeps me from dying, I guess I'll try it. All right, so there you have it. We're going to clear the dishes away here. Thanks to everybody for joining us for this dinner. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did.
Whoa, hey, and what do you know, folks? It looks like Julie Douglas has just teleported into the studio with us. Julie, what are you doing in here?
I don't know. And why am I still pixelated?
We got to work out some of the kinks in the system here, I think.
Yeah, stay away from her sharp corners.
All right. Well, hey, welcome back to Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
Yeah.
I hear you have some tremendous news to share with everybody.
I do. We have a new podcast that's coming out called The Stuff of Life, and it is a weekly podcast, and we're really excited by it. Noel Brown, our producer, and I have been working away at it. He's been creating some amazing sound design to go along with it. And basically each week we take a topic and we talk to a couple of experts, and then we weave in some discussion from the How Stuff Works Collective. And Joe has actually been on a couple of roundtables for some topics.
That's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been great.
I'm very excited to hear these, Julie. Can you give us any kind of preview about what the first episode is going to be about?
Yeah, the first episode is The Power of Fear. And so we talked to a couple of people who kind of have their boots on the ground, so to speak, a former firefighter and then a SWAT team member. And they talk about like the physiological effects of what's going on when you meet that moment where you really have to marshal all your resources. And then we talked to a professor at Chapman University who has a American Survey of Fears, and he talks about what Americans are obsessing about and the scary things that fill our nightmares.
What are they? Is it mostly mummies? It's mostly mummies, right?
No, mummies didn't make it on the list this year. Actually, what? Robert and I have talked about this survey before. And, it was, something like it was in 2014. The number one fear was the dark.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I think I'm remembering this one. Yeah.
Honestly, I would have guessed public speaking. Is it not public speaking?
Public speaking makes it into the top five, which we actually have a companion episode on as well.
Well, see, the dark can always contain mummies. So that mummy demographic is probably boosting the dark, whereas public speaking rarely contains mummies. So
yeah.
You're safe there no matter what.
For now.
Audiences full of mummies are surprisingly forgiving.
Well, yeah, I guess they would be.
They moan for more.
Run them, yeah.
Yeah, you can't really tell if it's like a good moan, bad moan. That's maybe why they're so forgiving.
And what kind of topics can listeners expect to roll out in the future?
Yeah, besides the power of fear and the fear of public speaking, which is the second episode, we'll have another episode about eternity and this idea that we try to immortalize ourselves. And we talked to Marius Irsake, who is a co-founder of Eternomy. Mm-hmm. And this is a website in which you can build an avatar of yourself. But he's doing it in such a way that you would interact with this avatar for decades, and aggregate all of your online information.
I joined the show to talk in the roundtable about this topic, and I thought it had some very weird implications.
Yeah, it sounds very Black Mirror. To a certain extent.
Yes.
That came up.
Yes. In fact, that is one of his influences. Oh, not cool. that he wants to create some sort dystopic version
show,
of that.
I want to bring this to life with my work.
Right.
No. He's all about the sort of utopian version of this and trying to actually use this as a tool for living as opposed to have it be some sort of representation of yourself after you die, although it can certainly do that too.
Cool.
So it's less a headstone and more just one more social media platform.
Possibly. One more hole to fall into.
Well, I'm really excited to hear these, Julie, and I'm really excited for this show. And I think all of our listeners, all of you guys out there really should be too, because they put a lot of work into this and it sounds like it's going to be amazingly interesting and super fun.
Yeah, I've heard one of the episodes myself. Great content. Really appreciating the amount of work that you and Noah are putting into it. Now, I'm going to make sure that there's a link on the landing page for this episode for listeners to explore the show. But where else can they go to get it?
They can go to really any place that they get their podcast from, including iTunes.
So you can subscribe, they might say?
Oh, yes, you can.
Yes?
Yes.
So they should subscribe to?
The Stuff of Life. And by the way, by the time this episode airs, the episode, The Power of Fear, will be out on iTunes. So that, now we're in the future now, but it actually dropped on January 27th.
So if you're listening, you don't have to wait. You can go check it out right this minute.
Yes.
And you're on social media as well?
We are. You can find us on the Stuff of Life on Facebook and also Twitter, Stuff of Life Show.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Julie. And see, it works out just when you started to smooth out on the edges. The pixels are disappearing, and now it's time for you to zap away into the ether.
That's always how it goes, right? Thank you so much for having me. And by the way, I love what you guys have done with the digs here. It looks great, and I love what you guys are doing.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah,
thank
I really
you, Julie.
Like you guys have taken the show into this beautiful direction. So,
all right.
Kudos.
All right. Well, thank you and best of luck with Stuff of Life. Everybody check it out. In the meantime, be sure to check out stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is our mothership. That's where you will find all the podcast episodes, blog posts, videos, links out to our various social media accounts. We're Blow the Mind on Facebook and Twitter. We are Stuff to Blow Your Mind on Tumblr. Follow us on those feeds. Keep up with what we're doing. And hey, if you listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher or, you know, you're using Google, you're using Spotify, however you do it, if there is some way to rate us and give us a positive rating or review, do that, because that really helps out the show, helps boost the algorithm, and you know, ensures that we get to continue to produce content like this for you.
And if you want to get in touch with us with any feedback on this episode or other recent ones, or let us know your favorite dangerous food, or if you've tried any of the foods we talked about today, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Diamonds Direct has done it again. This month only, get ready for an offer you can't resist. Buy a natural diamond engagement ring of 1 carat plus and receive a free natural 1 carat diamond tennis bracelet valued at $2,000. That's right, a stunning diamond tennis bracelet at no extra cost. Imagine giving her the ring of her dreams and her wedding gift all at once. So hurry into Diamonds Direct. Your chance to get a free tennis bracelet will not last long. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Is getting gas at Exxon burning a hole in your wallet? Get the Drop app. With Drop, you can earn free gift cards just by filling up your tank. Download Drop now. Use code DROP66 to instantly receive $5 in points.
Hello, iHeart listener. We have a confession to make. Both iHeart and this commercial you're listening to right now would probably sound a heck of a lot better on the new Roku Pro Series TV. It's got side-firing speakers that fill your room with sound, Dolby Atmos audio that puts you right in the middle of the entertainment, and the ability to pair seamlessly with your home theater sound systems that already have surround sound and booming bass. If all that sounds too good to be true, it'll sound even better on the new Roku Pro Series. Your hearing isn't better. Your TV is.